and welcome to the Libby's Podcast, conversations with authors who've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards, lovingly known as the Nibbies. I'm your host and longtime Nibbies fan, Hannah McInnes. These awards celebrate books and everyone who makes them, honouring the entire creative, collaborative journey of a book, from the author's mind to the reader's hand. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. Chat to some of today's best-loved authors about their books, their writing, what's gone on behind the scenes to get them to where they are, and those lovely moments when they and the books they've created have found their readers.
My name's Yomi Adegoke. I'm a journalist and author of the books Slay in Your Lane and the now Nibby nominated The List.
Congratulations on the shortlisting. And The List then, for those who haven't read it, tell us the characters and the issues at the centre of the story, and we'll talk about it more, but give us the rundown, the premise.
Sure. So in a nutshell, the book follows a kind of pseudo-influencer couple called Ola and Michael, who are engaged to be married in a month's time. They're very much considered, you know, sort of couple goals. They seem to have it all. But just before their wedding day, an anonymous list goes up on social media accusing lots of different men of varying degrees of abuse. And, you know, you've probably guessed it by now, Michael is named on the list. And Ola has to essentially decide whether she's going to stand by her man, so to speak, or whether she believes he's capable of what he's been anonymously accused of online.
Just from the nutshell, as you called it, explanation, already can tell big themes that you've chosen to deal with. Yes. Cancel culture, Me Too, assault, and issues that are often at the centre of so-called culture wars and tribalism, which you tackle with a real nuance. And I just wonder why you wanted to take on these themes and why that was important to you to see them from two sides.
Well, thank you for saying it was nuanced. That was definitely sort of my intention from the outset. I think I'm not the only person that I know anyway that, you know, wants to have a sort of more, I suppose, nuanced conversation about issues such as these. I think especially when it comes to, you know, quote unquote, cancel culture, but also when it comes to, you know, anonymously curated lists of allegations online. I'm always saying I could have written the list about anything, because first and foremost, it is a book about the internet, and it's about, you know, what happens when somebody is anonymously accused of something online. I could have written it about an Amazon review or a Goodreads review or something like that. But it would have been a far more boring book. I think I chose to look at this subject in particular just because, you know, the stakes are so much higher, but also because as a journalist, when I sort of came across lots of lists being disseminated in the industry, or, you know, various industries that sort of accused lots of different people of abuse, my knee-jerk reaction was that, you know, there's no smoke without fire. This is something that, you know, if you find yourself on a list like this, you've done something to find yourself on there. But then it kind of felt at odds with the rest of my thinking on the internet, which is that, you know, you can't believe everything you believe, sorry, everything you see on the internet, because it's the internet. And I think when it came to these specific kind of lists, I was less questioning because, you know, I very much understand why these lists exist. I think that they, you know, have an important purpose. I think that lots of people do genuinely contribute to lists of this type because they've been let down by various systems that are supposed to protect them. That being said, I also grew up in the time of, you know, Stranger Danger on MSN Messenger and, you know, MTV's Catfish, and have always had an awareness that what you see online might not be exactly what you think it is. And also, you know, as a journalist navigating the fake news crisis, one that we've seen get much, much worse in recent years, months, weeks because of AI, I just kind of felt, I think, slightly conflicted about this route whilst also understanding it. So I guess that's why I went into it with lots of questions and I really sought answers. And I think that's why the characters, you know, in turn ask a lot of questions, because it was me, you know, trying to, I guess, sort through what my conclusion was on this approach also.
It's so interesting. It is such a conflicting world, and wondering, as one of your characters does, whether you're letting a side down by not immediately supporting one
area when actually there is, as you've just mentioned, so much to consider. My goodness, going into your mind, hearing your answer to that has just kind of made me think of the spiral of uncertainty that I've been in so many of those situations as well. I mean, did something particular spark it and inspire it? One particular list or event?
I would say it was multiple different lists, but I think what really sparked it was me kind of realizing one day that I wasn't sure what I thought when I'd kind of originally, you know, like Ola, as a feminist, as someone who 100%, you know, has always gone with the mantra and still does in many ways, like, you know, believe women. I kind of thought I knew what I thought. And as time went on, you know, it became apparent that not only was I not so certain of what I thought, lots of people privately weren't certain of what they thought, because obviously online, we all have it figured out. We all know exactly what we think. We know what we do in that situation. But, you know, privately, I was having all kinds of conversations that showed that, especially with journalists, especially with people who, you know, I used to work at Channel 4 News, and, you know, you're bound by things like Ofcom regulations, and there's a real kind of, you know, there's a standard. You have to, things have to be true in order for you to say them. And still things are said that are not true in the press. But I think with a lot of like colleagues, I'd say as well, we were having lots of conversations, not necessarily even at Channel 4, because I'd left by the time by the time those lists were really being disseminated, but just fellow journalists, fellow nuanced thinkers, who were, I suppose, kind of tired of the idea that if you had questions about this method, that that then meant you were undermining, you know, survivors' experiences. And I think that's a really simplistic black and white view that the internet actually promotes, that if you're not with us, you're with them, that everything's black and white. And it's a viewpoint that, you know, the algorithm actually rewards. The more divisive your opinion, the more extreme it is, the more retweets you get. And I think a lot of people kind of feel like, well, hang on, most things in the world aren't best explained or discussed on Twitter threads. There are all kinds of, you know, contexts that need to be taken into account. And, you know, the reality is, when it comes to most other situations, we apply a level of, I suppose, skepticism, not in any way to undermine, you know, the people who feel the need to, you know, be heard through that method, but just because it's the internet. And I always sort of come back to that it's the internet. And, you know, it's interesting how we, on one hand, are so skeptical and so afraid of everything we read online and so worried about fake news. But then also, when it comes to other contexts, we kind of aren't, and we're kind of very willing to just go with stuff. So, yeah, I think I knew it'd be a very difficult conversation to have. But I think that's more, if anything, a sign of the times that it's so difficult to have that conversation, because I genuinely don't think that questioning that method in any way, you know, then calls women liars or suggests that, you know, women go out of their way to make things up in these circumstances. I think it just is a very realist position of acknowledging what, you know, how dangerous and how easy, I suppose, it is for well-meaning movements to be weaponized and taken advantage of online.
I can't say anything other than I couldn't agree more with absolutely everything you've said. I can't pick you up on any of that, because it is so well said. But a book feels like a brilliant place to explore these issues, because it can have nuance, it can explore something, and it can say this isn't binary. There's lots of light and shade, and there's so much more to this. But why did you decide on a novel? Why did you decide on fiction rather than nonfiction?
So it was actually going to be nonfiction. It was going to be a nonfiction long read, in which I essentially asked lots of questions and, you know, intended to approach with the same nuance that I did the novel. I really honestly didn't have any answers, and I was very interested in speaking to people from all sides of the debate. But that was in, goodness, I think it was either 2017, late 2017 or early 2018. The Me Too movement was very much like in its primordial stages. It was just a conversation that had like literally just begun. And I very much felt that it wasn't the right time. It felt like, you know, for so long, abuses within industries had been swept under the rug. And it felt like, you know, is it right for me to kind of problematize this conversation when it's just started? Like, it just felt a bit early. So I really, and I still, you know, just didn't know what I thought also. So I just thought maybe I should take a little bit of time out, wait to kind of formulate my real opinions on this. Several years passed, I still didn't know what I thought. But it was lockdown. And I'm always saying, you know, everyone else was, you know, making sourdough bread and everyone else could cook. So they were like doing that. And I was like, well, I cannot cook. I'm an abysmal cook. So I was like, I do also, however, want to make the most of this strange time that we're in where we can't leave our houses and, you know, there's endless time. So I kind of like, you know, revisited the idea, but then it was like, maybe this is an easier conversation to have. I say easier very much in quotation marks, but maybe it is an easier conversation to have in fiction. And I hadn't written, like, I'd written a short story before for an anthology several years ago, and I'd just published a children's book with my best friend, Elizabeth Yvebenene, and co-author Elizabeth Yvebenene. But I'd never tried, you know, a long form fiction like novel. And it was, I just thought, I've absolutely got nothing to lose. Like, even if it turns out to be absolutely rubbish, who cares? I'll just say that's something I tried during lockdown, like how people tried all kinds of things during lockdown. So that's literally why, honestly, I wish it was a more kind of thoughtful answer, but it really was. It was lockdown. I can't cook. And I had nothing else to do. And I thought this could be a slightly more, you know, gentle entry to the debate, I thought.
Oh, I truly love that. I can't bake. So instead of baking sourdough, I thought I'd write a novel.
It makes me sound so impressive.
The most complex themes that are sort of, you know, facing society today, as you do. But the book you sent out initially was with some chapters written, as I understand it.
Yes.
And you know, very competitive. A lot of people wanted it. Of course they did. HarperCollins and Fourth Estate are your publishers.
Yes.
And I just wonder what it was like for you then working with this as part of that team. The moment it goes away from you and your desk and your lockdown thoughts into a collaborative experience. What were standout moments from that?
Oh my goodness. Well, so I have only ever been a co-author. I've co-written Slaying Your Lame with my best friend, aforementioned, and written multiple books with her, actually. And I love to collaborate. I think that's probably the best way I work. So writing a novel was really lonely, actually, like really lonely. Mm-hmm. Very much like, you know, I relied a lot on my close friends to kind of give me feedback. And then that was difficult because then they'd give me honest feedback and then I'd be defensive and knee jerk if they didn't love it immediately. So that came with its own complications, but I'm so appreciative that they, you know, were there for me because I really thrive on collaboration. So I actually loved it when I was able to sort of begin working with Fourth Estate, not just because I've only ever worked with Fourth Estate and I've worked with them since 2016 when they took a punt on Slaying Your Lame. And I always say this was very much before, you know, it was pre-2020, it was pre, you know, the second kind of like iteration of Black Lives Matter when conversations around diversity were slightly more mainstream. They really supported and backed that book to the hilt. And, you know, I had such a brilliant experience with them. And, you know, we took the book out to auction, myself and my agent, the brilliant Hayley Steed, who was then at Madeline Milburn. And as you mentioned, I'd only written 9 chapters, but I knew I wouldn't have time to finish the book because I had all these other commitments. And Hayley just totally believed in it and was like, let's send it out anyway on submission. So we did. There was like a big bidding war. And it's so funny because I think in my gut, I always knew that Fourth Estate won't like this. Like, I always knew I wanted to go with Fourth Estate, but then it's like, obviously post auction, it's like they kind of were forced to offer more money, which worked out great. So I think in my gut, I was like, I kind of want to go with them, but let's see what everyone else says. And then it was like, oh, actually, there are lots of brilliant other publishing houses that want to buy this book. And then it's like, this drove up the price. And I was like, oh, I'm going with Fourth Estate anyway. But they are, you know, I think I'm so lucky because not only was this a very difficult book subject-wise, very divisive, as I knew it would be, I also knew it would be potentially alienating because it's not just got black protagonists, but it's very, very authentically written. if I say so myself, like I know I didn't hold back in terms of the depiction of the characters being, yes, flawed and complicated, but also like speaking in the way that they would, being from inner city, like, you know, urban communities. You know, we're looking at second generation African immigrants who speak with like particular slang, and sometimes their parts aren't even in English. And I knew that that was something Fourth Estate would support, because when me and Elizabeth wrote Slaying Your Lane, we wrote that also very authentically, and there was zero pressure from our publisher to kind of conform or write it in a way that was, you know, more mainstream. That being said, Slaying Your Lane was dealing with complicated issues, but it was kind of like one complicated issue, whereas with The List, it's like multiple complicated issues and then also very specific world. And the support that I received, like I could not possibly like wax lyrical enough about it. Like everything from, you know, all the way down to the cover, which I was so specific on, because I was like, somehow this has to work for women and men and feel Instagrammable and feel chic, but also kind of be elevated and taken seriously. I had all these requirements. It took us 9 months to put an emoji on the front cover of a book. And they were so, they've always been so supportive in terms of supporting the vision. And, you know, when it came to edits and stuff, like, of course, you know, just in constant dialogue, but also them really trusting me and my judgment to tell this story, and trusting the readers that they would also come on board with a book that, you know, is talking about a very particular type of person that, that a lot of readers might not know. So I, in short, loved it. Like, I've only ever had a brilliant experience working. I feel very, very lucky to work with Fourth Estate. And it's always been a great experience. But I think The List took it to such a different level, because it, I was amazed at the fact that a book this divisive and different was also so, you know, I suppose supported in the mainstream. And I know that is Fourth Estate's doing. The fact that they took it on as a super lead and treated it like any other book that they wanted to go big with. It's just meant the world.
Oh, that's really great to hear. And you say about the cover, and it is just an emoji, but it is so much more than an emoji. And I was just thinking, can I find the words to describe it? And I feel listeners who can't see and they haven't seen it yet, if they haven't, need to just Google and see what the cover looks like. Because we can't describe this. Right. Just really, it has such an impact.
It's bold. Yeah, it is bold.
It's bold and it's clever. You talk about the readers, and I'm also really interested to know how you found with this book interacting with those readers, meeting them at events, the sorts of things that they said to you that meant a lot to you or had an impact on you in some way.
My gosh. So with Slaying Your Lane, I remember that like I was really overwhelmed, I suppose, because we wrote a book about Black women that then we would hear about from various different types of people. I think it's been very similar with The List, where I don't know, like I knew that my agent really believed in it and I knew that Fourth Estate really believed in it, but I don't know, there was still part of me that just thought, you know, I don't know if we're ready for this conversation. And also maybe the entry point would be slightly less divisive if we're having the conversation with, you know, like white characters from Middle England, and it's slightly more accessible. So I just never thought it would go as big. And I think what has just been so amazing in terms of like going to events and meeting lots of different people, it's just the kinds of people. Like I will meet, like, you know, people older than my parents that are like, I don't know anything about the internet. I find it terrifying and scary, and the book has actually made it me even more terrified of it. That being said, like I, you know, went to go and find the List playlist and listen to all the Afrobeat song and the songs in the UK rap, because I really like the sound of it in the book. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like it, I wouldn't really say I'm an emotional person, but I am like quite moved by that stuff. And I do find myself on a daily basis, like screenshotting Instagram DMs I get, so that when I'm in a bad mood, I can like read all the lovely things that people have said to me, because it is truly so touching. I think I knew that when it came to, you know, the Black community, that just as they had with our other books, myself and Elizabeth, they'd really supported it. I wasn't like, I was expecting and hoping for that. But I think people who don't necessarily know people like Ola and Michael really still empathizing with them, that's meant a lot to me. Because I think often when we look at, you know, characters, people don't immediately identify white characters as white, as having a lens, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like whiteness is often seen as a default lens, and anything else is kind of like a deviation and kind of like more complicated, and people feel like they can't relate to it. But then it's like, as a black reader, I've been reading about white characters my whole life, and I always find, you know, a universal experience I'm able to empathize with. But I've experienced some people saying, oh, I can't get behind these characters, because, you know, I don't know people like this. But the vast majority of people have been like, I don't know anyone like this, and that makes me want to read more because I'm really interested in this world. But also, I recognize myself, you know, as a 70 plus Scottish woman, as one woman said to me, like, you know, living in the Highlands, she's recognizing herself in this like late 20s British Ghanaian man, like in London. And that means a lot. I think also what's meant a lot, honestly speaking, has been hearing from so many survivors that have, you know, that basically can see both sides of the debate, in the sense that they understand that this is not in any way, you know, an attack on even necessarily these kinds of lists, really, but also like it's certainly not an attack on women's, you know, whisper networks or right to self-organize and discuss, you know, what their experiences, but also understanding that, that, you know, or relating to the idea of just the queasiness when it comes to internet culture, call out culture, cancel culture, and how, you know, easy it is for things to spread without evidence online. That has really, really meant a lot, because obviously a fear I had was that people would think I was trying to shout down women's experiences. And so many women who've been through a lot of things have reached out to me and you know, said it's really resonated with them, and that's been incredible. But yeah, I don't know if any writers ever get to a point where they're kind of like, I don't know, like used to it, but for me, every single message like is bookmarked, saved, you know, screenshotted, because it truly does mean so much to me. I'm still, you know, bowled over by the response to it.
I mean, I love hearing that from writers, just that even hugely successful writers, people successful in their own right, as you are, still find that they are living the dream. It's so refreshing. Oh, absolutely. And so lovely to always hear that. Oh, and actually those two things you describe, are no wonder they would feel emotional. People from all ages and all places relating to and walking in the shoes of others. Absolutely. Is, you know, the power of books, isn't it? And if people say that, then you've done your job so well. I'm interested just lastly about the TV rights, which have been bought to this. I think you're executive producing. That's not a secret, is it?
It's not, no.
Do you write with the idea of it coming alive on screen in your mind?
So you know what? I don't. And it's interesting, because I know a lot of people have said to me like, oh my gosh, you must have written this with TV in mind. And honestly speaking, I think it's because I know what the first draft was, as does my agent, who read it and was like, you know what? It's like a story I tell a lot that I'd sent through, I think it was 80,000 words. And my agent was like, this is great, love it, cut like 50,000. Because so much of it was very navel gazing, very like serious in a way that I'm not. And the thing is, I always write about serious things. I always have for my whole journalistic career, but I've always brought an element of levity because that's just who I am as a person. And I think when I was writing the book initially, I felt very conscious of, you know, my identity as a female author, and also a female author that's black, and a female author that, like, you know, wants to be taken seriously, but also likes, you know, like not necessarily likes, but uses Instagram, likes clothes, XYZ. So I was very conscious, especially coming from like, you know, a serious news background, that I wouldn't be taken seriously. So the first draft was so dry. Like, it was super dry. Nothing happened. Like, literally nothing happened. Like, it was very much, you know, some people have been like, wow, they're so in their heads. And I'm like, oh my God, they wouldn't have even made it a third of the first draft. It was just ruminating about what this meant for them. And, you know, as time went on and I received feedback from friends and colleagues and professionals who were kind of like, you could make this more dynamic. And it's not something that I didn't want to do. It was something I was scared to do, because I thought, God, everyone's just going to say, like, this isn't a real book. This isn't serious. But then I had to think about, you know, the books I actually read, the kind of things I enjoy. I mean, I watch Lifetime movies, non-ironically. Like, I really do love things to have. I love pace. I love things to be interesting. And that's how the book honestly became what it is. It was me being like, you know what? actually, funny enough, interviewing Kylie Reid, of all people, who I'm a big fan of, and she'd spoken, you know, I'd asked her a question when I was interviewing her for something about, you know, kind of balancing being a real author, inverted commas, but also like wanting to write things that are fun and interesting. And, you know, she, I can't remember exactly what she said, but it was pretty much along the lines of, why not? Like, just write what you enjoy, write what you'd like to read. And I was like, well, if Kylie Reid can write Such a Fun Age, which is so dynamic and interesting, but also looks at serious things, then maybe I can do the same. And that's how, you know, it kind of went from, you know, just this couple plodding along, like, you know, without anything really happening. I mean, the wedding wasn't happening for, I think, a year in the original version. It went to something that is a lot more pacey and interesting. Because I was like, I would have never read the first version, honestly speaking. I would never read that draft that I wrote. My agent was definitely right to tell me to get rid of 90% of it. But yeah, so I genuinely don't think about it. It's just something that I think, because I like to read those kind of things. I think Yellow Face is a brilliant book. I think Such a Fun Age is a brilliant book. I kind of wanted to emulate that, and that's kind of how it was born. But I would be lying if I said I didn't hope. Of course, every author hopes. Do you know what I mean? Like, I did cross my fingers that it might happen, and I'm very, very grateful, and still in disbelief that it has, with HBO and A24 and BBC of all people.
Oh, it's really exciting. And I mean, I don't know how you cut words. I feel that is the most impossible sounding thing to do. Also, that people ask you often, as you say they do, whether you envisaged it coming to life on screen is only a huge compliment, because I suppose if any book can make you visualize it and bring it to life in your head and think about that question, then again, it's doing the right thing. Reflecting, I couldn't agree more about Kylie Reid. I've been lucky enough to interview her, and she's just a great all-round brilliant author and human, isn't she? And that kind of fun and kindness and loveliness and twinkle in her eye comes into her books as well.
Absolutely.
So tell me lastly what it means to you to be shortlisted for this NIBY.
I just feel like it's just such a culmination of, I mean, I've just felt on cloud nine for, you know, since 2020, like, you know, obviously to varying degrees, but like, you know, in terms of the list, like, yeah, I've felt so overwhelmed and just grateful. And I think, you know, this is just the biggest cherry on top of the most massive cake ever. I feel like there is nothing like receiving a nod like this from your peers, especially as someone who, like, you know, has kind of done that, has made that pivot from journalism to publishing. And I feel like this is now my bread and butter, and it's something I do more and more in terms of like navigating the book world. And I feel like with a book as divisive as mine, I knew that, like, you know, I knew it was going to split opinion for sure. So I kind of felt like it's difficult, I'd say. And I think a lot of people that write books that are in any way kind of divisive might relate, where it can be difficult to know the quality of a thing, because a lot of people are focused on, you know, whether it should exist or not, because it's like, well, you know, should we even talk about this? So I think receiving, like, so I think, especially as someone who's, you know, a journalist and has written as a critic before, I've always very much like really valued the opinion of my peers and people within the industry. And to have that nod, like, it just, and twice, my God, because I got to be nominated in two categories, especially when I was such a diva about the audiobook and was like so particular about wanting a Rinze and Sheila specifically with Ola and Michael, and feeling it come off in those nominations. It means so much, because I just think it, like, it hits differently, for lack of a better phrase. Like, it just feels, it's so wonderful to hear, like, from readers who've enjoyed it. But I must say, there is something when it's your peers, when it's people within the industry giving you that nod. And I think it's why actors get so emotional at the Oscars and they thank the Academy, because it's people within, do you know what I mean? It's like people within there that they work with and people that are in the same industry as them that are giving them those flowers. And it just means a lot in a very, very specific way. So I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful and excited for the 13th.
I mean, we haven't really even talked about the audiobook specifically, but that is also an enormous treat. And what amazing people, as you say, you've had to narrate it. Really, the best of the best. But I have to let you go, because the half an hour is up. And as I said to you before this interview, I was going to find it very difficult to let you go with many more questions. But thank you very much. If you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to subscribe to the series to hear more conversations with Nibby's authors. And we'd love it if you'd rate it and leave us a review. Do visit thebookseller.com/British-book-awards to find out more about the industry's biggest celebration of books and all who make them. This podcast was produced by Heavy Entertainment.